Parashas Ve'era has the first seven of the ten plagues, and also the prelude to them, the demonstration of Moshe and Aaron turning the staff into a snake. Now, Paro had Chartumim, Chachamim, Chashvim, Chartumim, wise men, sorcerers, necromancers, who attempted to go toe-to-toe with Moshe and Aaron and duplicate all the things that they did. And apparently they succeeded. When it comes to the snake, they apparently initially succeeded. When it comes to the snake, it says, Vayikra gam paro lachachamim v'lamachashafim, Vayasu gam hem chartfim mitzrayim v'latem kain. They indeed transformed their staves into snakes as well. It says Aaron's staff swallowed theirs, but they at least succeeded in turning their staves into snakes. The first of the ten plagues, the plague of Dam, after Aaron turned the water of Mitzrayim into Dam, it says, Vayasu chen chartmei Mitzrayim b'lateim. They did it too. They also turned water into blood. The plague of Tzfardea, after Aaron brought forth the Tzfardea, Vayasu chen chartmei b'lateim. Paro's necromancers did the same thing with their incantations. They also brought forth frogs. It was only the third plague, Makas Kinim, that it says the Chartumim tried and they couldn't do it and they were forced to concede, Etzba Elokimhi, this is the finger of God. And after that, we don't find that they appeared again. They gave up, apparently, and they no longer try to match Moshe and Aaron. As we've mentioned previously, this story is one of only two stories in Tanakh that seems to relate as an actual event the practice of magic. There are many prohibitions in the Torah, warnings not to engage in magic, al tifnu el ha'ovos, vel ha'yidonim, execute witches, mechashef lo sechaya, lo se'oninu, v'lo se'nachashu. There are many different prohibitions and admonitions and punishments against engaging in different types of occult practices. But in terms of narrative accounts of people actually performing magic, there are only two accounts in Tanakh of people actually performing magic. This is one, the Chartumim of Mitzrayim, who successfully, it seems, performed magic for the snakes, the staff and the snake, and for Dam and Tzfardea. The other account appears in Sefer Shmuel, at the end of Shmuel Aleph. Shaul HaMelech is in disgrace. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not communicating with him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is upset at him for certain things he did wrong. Shaul is on the eve of a climactic battle against the Plishtim. Shaul is desperate to hear a word from God, so he seeks out a balas ov, a witch, a necromancer, who could apparently raise the spirits of the dead. He asks her, he disguises himself, he asks her to raise the spirit of his dead mentor, Shmuel HaNavi. She does, the Navi describes she does so, and Shmuel talks to them, and Shmuel tells him what's going to happen. There's going to be a catastrophic loss against the Plishtim. He's going to die, his sons are going to die, and that indeed is what happened. Shaul and his sons died, and the Jews suffered a catastrophic loss to the Plishtim. So these are the only two cases where the Torah seems to be describing actual magic, the Chartumim of Mitzrayim, and the Balas Ov in the story of the Balas Ov at Ein Dor in the story of Shaul and Shmuel. Now, we've mentioned there is a major dispute among the great Jewish thinkers as to whether magic is real, as to whether all these various types of occult practices are real. Can people actually do supernatural things by the use of magic? Just to clarify, just to be very clear about this, everyone within anything approaching mainstream orthodoxy agrees that God performs miracles, God created the world, God is above nature, God made the laws of nature, God can override the laws of nature as he sees fit. So it's fundamental to belief in our Torah that God can act in a supernatural way. There are many nisim in the Torah. There are the nisim of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the ten plagues, Kriyas Yamsuf, the nisim of the Mun, and the bring water from the rock, many nisim in Tanakh, the Yarden, the Shemesh stopping at Givon, according to most commentaries. Virtually everyone agrees, everyone within anything approaching orthodoxy agrees that God himself can produce miracles. The question is...
If you accept that God created the world...
Sorry?
If you accept that God created the world, everything else is not a miracle. It's just like nothing, right?
Right. He's pointing out that once he created the world, everything else is just detail. So creating the world, he made the laws of nature. He made something out of nothing, according to most Jewish thinkers. So everything else is pales in comparison to the miraculous act of creating the world. Yes. So from our modern perspective, from the perspective of the ancients, everyone agrees that God can do miracles. God can override the laws of nature. The question we're considering here is whether humans, who are not acting as agents of God, the Nisim and Tanakh are generally through Nevi'im. Some say it's only through Nevi'im, but we're talking about private people, sorcerers, not even particularly good men necessarily, magicians and sorcerers. Do they have the power, using a kind of parallel system to the laws of nature, the laws of magic? You can read about it in fantasy books and so on, or even just in historical works of what people believed hundreds of years ago. Some people still believe these things today. Is this real? Can people use some kind of system of magic and occult systems to manipulate the world and accomplish things not in accordance with the standard laws of nature? So this is a major machlokas among the Rishonim, among the traditional Jewish thinkers. Ibn Ezra and Rambam and the Gaonim, as we'll discuss, did not believe in magic, in certain types of magic, in all types of magic. Ibn Ezra says, discussing the prohibition against Ov, Aleph Vav Beis, is a kind of, some kind of, that's what the Balas Ov in the story of Shaul did. She could communicate with the dead, bring forth the dead. Ibn Ezra says, Reke Moach Amru, people whose heads are empty of brains. They say, if Ov is not true, it's not a real thing, and if same thing with Kishuf, the Torah would not have prohibited them, meaning Ibn Ezra says these empty-headed people think anything the Torah goes to the trouble of prohibiting must be real. The Torah wouldn't waste its time prohibiting things that are nonsense to begin with. That's the position of the Reke Moach. Ibn Ezra says, and I say, Hepach Devrayim, you can see where he's going with this. If he calls them empty-headed, that's pretty clear he's not going to agree with this. He says, I say just the opposite. Hakasav Loas Ar HaEmes Rak HaSheker, the Torah does not prohibit things that are true. The prohibitions of the Torah are directed only against things that are false, like Elilim and Psilim of Avodah Zarah. And he says, if not for the fact that I don't want to hold forth at too great length here, he says, I would explain to you the story of the Balas Ov, Barayas Gmuros, with solid proofs. Basically, he acknowledges that the story of the Balas Ov seems to contradict this. The Torah seems to be describing Ov as a real thing. I could explain it to you, but I'm not going to, because I want to keep my comments brief. And he doesn't mention the story of the Mechashvim, the Chartumim, and Mitzrayim. In other words, those Rishonim like Ibn Ezra, like Rambam, as we're about to see, who say that magic is not real, have to deal with all the prohibitions in the Torah. We could say the Torah is prohibiting Sheker, like Avodah Zarah. But they have to deal with these two narrative accounts of apparent magic really working, the Chartum of Mitzrayim and the story of the Balas Ov. Ibn Ezra alludes to the story of the Balas Ov and says, I could explain it to you, but I'm not going to. Rambam is probably the most famous Jewish thinker who utterly rejects the realness of any type of occult and magical practice. After he exhaustively categorizes all types of different magical and occult practices in the laws of Avodah Zarah, the Rambam writes, he brings all the halachas that we find in the Gemara, all the rules of magic in the Torah, the prohibitions. He writes, Dvarim ha'elu kulon divrei sheker v'chazavein. All these things are falsehood and nonsense. These are the reason it's in Avodah Zarah is because these are the tricks by which the ancient idolaters would manipulate people, would fool people into following their idols. But Yisrael, who are chachamim uchukamim, Yisrael, who are superlatively wise people, should not be drawn after such nonsense and not to contemplate they might actually be real. Kilo nachash b'Yaakov, lo kesem b'Yisrael. Yisrael is above such primitive, pagan, nonsensical beliefs. Anyone who believes these things and believes that they're real and chachma, but the Torah prohibits such things, someone who has such an attitude, like the Reke Moach of the Ibn Ezra, Einam Ela Min Haschalim, like Ibn Ezra, he says such people are fools, Umechusrei Hadas, they're lacking Das. However, he says, Balei Achachma, Utmimei Hadas, those who possess wisdom and firm and solid intellects, will know, Barayas Bruros, echoing the same language of Ibn Ezra, Rayas Bruros, clear proofs, that all these things the Torah prohibits, like the Ibn Ezra says, the Torah lo astro ha'emes ela ha'sheker, Rambam echoes the language pretty closely, all the things the Torah prohibits are not chachma, they're tohu v'hevel, that chasri adas, the people of imperfect intellects, were drawn after, and they abandoned kol darka ha'emes. That's why the Torah says, when the Torah talks about these havalim, these nonsensical things, Tamim tiyem Hashem alokecha. You should not believe such foolishness. What about the story of the Balasov? So we have the Radak. So the Rambam doesn't. The Rambam does not address either of these two narratives, neither the narrative of the Chartumim of Mitzrayim nor the narrative of the Balasov. On the narrative of the Balasov, we have an amazing passage in the Radak. The Radak was a follower of the Rambam to some extent. He was an admirer and follower of the Rambam. But nevertheless, he was also more traditional. He often defers to Chazal and is sometimes not willing to be too radical in his ideas and his explanation of the Psukim. When he gets to the story of the Balas Ov, the Radak writes, we have seen, he says, a machlokas between the Gaonim. The Gaonim were the great heads of the yeshivas in Bavel, the period before the medieval period, more than 1,000 years ago. The Gaonim, he says, disagreed. Now, the Gaonim all agreed, he said, that the practice of Ov is hevel v'tohu, it's nonsense and vanity, v'divrei chaza v'hitul, it's lies, it's a mockery, he says. Ov is ridiculous, Ov does not, there's no such thing as Ov. You can't call down to this world the spirits of the dead through occult means. So what happened in the story of the Balas Ov? The story the Navi describes, she seems to have done just that. He brings two explanations. The first explanation is that of Rav Shmuel ben Chafni Gaon. Rav Shmuel ben Chafni was not one of the more famous. He was pretty famous, but he's not as well known. He's not as well known as Gaonim like Rav Hai and Rav Sadia and Rav Shira. But he was a prolific writer and a very interesting thinker. He was something of a rationalist. He was perhaps the first great post-Talmudic rationalist, the predecessor of the Rambam. He studied Greek wisdom, the philosophy of the time, and he was actually well connected to the more famous Gaonim. He was a mechutan with Rav Shrira. Rav Shrira Gaon, one of the most famous of the Gaonim. Rav Shmuel ben Chafni's daughter married Rav Shrira's son, Rav Hai Gaon, perhaps the most famous and most important to the Gaonim. So Rav Hai Gaon was a son-in-law of Rav Shmuel ben Chafni. Rav Hai Gaon actually is the one who records some of the little we know of Rav Shmuel ben Chafni's thought. He says that there were some people like Rav Shmuel ben Chafni who followed Greek wisdom and they were led astray by it and they believed some things that are not quite in accordance with the Torah. So Rav Shmuel ben Chafni was something of a rationalist. And the Radak says, how did he understand the story of the Balas Ov? He said, Balas Ov were charlatans. They were frauds. The way magicians work today, they guess. They're cunning. They used to hide people in a hiding place and have that person talk and pretend it was the spirit speaking. Somebody who was hidden would be casting his voice and pretending that it was the spirit speaking. The whole thing was a game and a con and a fraud. And everything that happened in the story in Sefer Shmuel was all fraud, was all a con perpetrated by the Balas Ov. None of it really happened. In other words, it's kind of a modern literary approach. Sometimes the narrator of a story doesn't write the objective facts. It's not the omniscient author. He's writing from the perspective of the characters. The Navi is describing what Shaul thought he was seeing. It looked to Shaul like, when it says, Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul, Shmuel said to Shaul, that means, from Shaul's perspective, it looked to him like Shmuel. It seemed to him Shmuel was speaking. It's not objectively what happened. That's all what Shaul. We're looking at the whole scene through Shaul's eyes. How did she get everything right? She predicted accurately what would happen in the battle. She guessed. That's how they do it today. That she realized that she saw the writing on the wall. She realized there was a big battle going. She realized the morale of the Jewish people was low, that they were terrified of the Plishtim. That's how they do things today. They can read certain cues about a person, they can guess, they can extrapolate. Everything she did was based on guesswork, was full of lies and manipulation. Everything she did was bogus. When she said, you're going to die, that was a svara, she was just guessing. This is the opinion of Rav Shmuel ben Chafni Gaon, and then he says something incredible. He expresses the rationalist credo that reason and intellect is the most reliable guide to truth. He says, even though the mashmos of Chazal and the Gemara is that they believe this, that they believe that the story happened kipshuto, she actually raised the spirit of Shmuel, she brought the spirit of Shmuel to appear before Shaul. Chazal seemed to have believed that a Balas Ov works and that she actually did this in the story. Says Rav Shmuel ben Chafni, even though that's what Chazal seemed to have believed, we cannot accept such things because it is against Seichel. At the end of the day, our Seichel has to be our guide. If our reason and our philosophy tells us this cannot be, we reject it, even though Chazal seemed to have taken it literally. Radak goes on. He says, Rav Sadia and Rav Hai say, they don't think this is a plausible shot. They say that the fact that she was so accurate in her prediction, that's implausible, that she could have guessed so accurately. It's also implausible that she could have actually done this. So they agree with Rishul ben Chafni that Balas Ov is completely against reason. There's no such thing. They also disagree with his interpretation that she just guessed. It was all her guessing. They say that she was a charlatan. She was a fraud, like Rishul ben Chafni. Hashem, for reasons best known to him, decided to communicate, to take this opportunity to communicate with Tishol through this woman. Why he couldn't just answer Shaul through all the other means. It says Shaul tried to contact God in various ways. Why Kadosh Baruch Hu turned him down and then finally revealed himself to Shmuel through the Balas Ov, I don't know. God's ways are sometimes inscrutable. Kadosh Baruch Hu decided he would take advantage of the Balas Ov to send Shaul a message. But she was a fraud. She was just as surprised as anybody else. She cried out, Tizik Mekol Gadol. She was maybe even more surprised than everyone else. Everyone else, you know, maybe believed Ov was real. She knew it was bogus. And then all of a sudden, Shmuel is actually appearing. She must have been scared out of her wits. That's what Rav Sadia and Rav Hai say. Rav Hai is Rav Shulman Chafni's son-in-law. So they both say that Ov is indeed a fraud, but in this particular case, uniquely, it was real because the Kadosh Baruch Hu chose to send Shaul a message. So Radak himself does not agree with this. He says he has problems with these pshatim. He sides with Chazal. But in any event, this is presumably something like this is how the Rambam or the Ben Ezra would have understood the story of the Balas Ov, that it's not actually real. Either it was a complete fraud and we're being told the story through the way it appeared to Shaul, or that it was a special revelation from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But there's no such thing as Ov. What about the Chartumim of our parasha? What were they doing? So we have Pshatim, Abarbanel and Malvin bring Pshatim, that it was sleight of hand. They moved very quickly, it was dark, there was smoke, it was illusion. The same way magicians work today. They have all kinds of incredibly ingenious tricks. If you watch a good stage magician, you can be amazed, you can be baffled. How on earth did he do that? You know it's not real magic. Sometimes they can show you the tricks, you can read about them in books with secret compartments and misdirection and palming things and physical dexterity and so on. They have all kinds of tricks that they do. But it can look very, very persuasive to someone who is not in on the trick. That's what the Chartumim were doing. Some of the Mefarshim say they were engaged in some kind of sleight of hand and some kind of manipulation and misdirection, the same way people do it today. But it's not real. So this is the machlokes between the two schools of thought. We have Ibn Ezra, Rambam, the Gaonim, who say these things are not real. The Gaonim was speaking specifically about Ov. I don't know if they would have said all magic is not real, or particularly bringing spirits down is not real. Rambam and Ibn Ezra say it about magic in general, including Ov. These things are not real. And we have the more traditional school of thought, the apparent opinion of Chazal and many other Rishonim, as we'll discuss soon, who believe that these things are actually real. The Rashba has a tshuva, which we'll discuss in more detail a little bit later. The Rashba has a tshuva, a long tshuva. Again, we'll discuss the context of the tshuva soon. But his correspondent had said that the Torah only prohibits those things that have some reality to them, because then there's a real concern. People will be led astray in worship of Avodah Zarah and so on. Says the Rashba, maybe, but the Rambam disagrees. Your position is that of the Reke Moach, of the people the Rambam says are not Chasei Reidas. The Rambam disagrees. The Rambam says just the opposite, that everything the Torah prohibits is false and not real. Says the Rashba, who do I think is right here? So the Rashba writes his tshuva with great humility. He starts the tshuva by saying, I'm going to discuss and dispute what you said and what the Rambam said, not k'meshival dvarav, not to critique. I'm not so bold I would just critique and refute the Rambam, but just k'choker v'shoal, I'm just going to try to investigate, understand, and analyze. The Rashba says, ilu haya b'yadenu l'hachriya. If I was great enough to take sides and to resolve this question, it would seem to me more like your opinion, like the Reke Moach, not like Ibn Ezra and Rambam, because the Gemara, he brings the Gemara in some places, seems to indicate that the magic is real. And these two stories, the two stories in Tanakh, the story of the Ov and Yidoni in the case of Shaul, and the Chartume Mitzrayim. Sheida Torah Shlema, our complete Torah, testifies that they did magic. So the simple reading of the biblical text, as well as the Gemara, is that magic is real. So the Rashba inclines toward the traditional view. There's also a famous passage of the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna was very traditional and was a believer in Kabbalah, and he was vehemently opposed to the Rambam's attitude, the Rambam's attitude based on Greek philosophy, rationalism, and skepticism. So the Vilna Gaon comments about the Rambam. He has a famous diatribe against the Rambam. Ironically, his diatribe is in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. Because the Shulchan Aruch was a great admirer of the Rambam. Yosef Karo was a great admirer of the Rambam. Even though the Shulchan Aruch's worldview is not that of the Rambam, he was a Kabbalist in Tzfas, in the circle of the Mekubalim. He had a Magid, a heavenly visitor who spoke to him. His whole view of the world was very different from that of the Rambam. But nevertheless, he had great admiration for the Rambam, and much of his language in Shulchan Aruch is drawn straight from the Rambam. So in the Laws of Kishuf, the Rambam writes, discussing certain incantations, which maybe we'll get to later, the Rambam says you're allowed to do these formula, these incantations, even though they don't work, you're allowed to do it because they calm down the sick person and his life is in danger. If he believes it and he wants you to do it, you can do it because it's not actually Avodah Zarah, and it has a positive effect because it'll calm him down, even though it's not a placebo effect, even though it's not objectively beneficial. So that language of the Rambam, even though it's not objectively beneficial, is based on his skeptical attitude that all kinds of occult practices are not real. And the Shulchan Aruch, whatever he may have thought about the Rambam's overall view of the world, codifies this language: you're allowed to engage in lachash, even though it's ein amol klum, even though it doesn't work, it's not efficacious. Says the Gaon, this is from the Rambam, but everyone, all the subsequent scholars disagree, because the Gemara is full of examples of incantations. The Rambam was swayed by philosophy, and he wrote that all these occult practices, kshafim, sorcery, shemus, the theurgic power of divine names, angelic names, lachashim, incantation, shadim, demons, kmeyos, amulets, all of this is sheker. Ram doesn't believe in any of this. Says the Gaon, the Rambam is deeply mistaken about this. Farhikuo su al kadkado, they smack the Rambam upside the head, because there are many stories in the Gemara full of magical names and kishuf. And the Torah says, Vayutaninim, in our parsha, it says that the staves of the sorcerers of Egypt became snakes. Apparently they had the power to do that. Amulets and lachash, there are many accounts of these things in the Gemara. The Pilosophia, it was the fault of philosophy. I believe some Girsos have Philosophia Ha'arura, the cursed philosophy, led him astray due to its deep seductiveness. To explain the Gemara in an allegorical and rationalistic way, to take them out of their pashup shot. Chas v'shalom, says the Vilna Gaon, eini maimon mehem, I do not believe these approaches. Lo mehamonam, I reject all of this. Everything Chazal said is kipshutan. However, even the Gaon agrees it's not mamish kipshutan. Sheyesh behem pnimiyos, there are indeed inner and deeper meanings to some of these stories. At least some of these stories, v'lo pnimiyos shel bali pilosofia, but not the pnei pnimiyos of the philosophers. Those are really chitonius. El Shabbali HaEmes of the Mekubalim. There are indeed deeper aspects to these stories, but the Rambam completely missed the boat on this, he says, and magic is indeed real. This machlokas between the Rambam and Ibn Ezra and maybe the Gaonim on the one hand against the simple reading of Chazal and the Rashba and the Gaon on the other hand, it's largely a philosophical machlokas, but it's also a halachic machlokas as well. As we've seen, let's go back to that tshuva of the Rashba. The Rashba wrote a very long tshuva, more than one tshuva actually, about a highly controversial case in his time, in the 14th or 13th or early 14th century. The Rashba's discussion revolves around something called Tzuras HaAryeh, the image of the lion. There was a therapeutic technique that was popular in his time that involved drawing the image of a lion. It was a cure for some serious disease. He says, what would they do? He says, they would make a tzura of an aryeh. They would draw some kind of picture of a lion on metal, lurafua. It was believed to have therapeutic value. And he says, there were different versions. Some said they offered some kind of incense. That, he says, is more problematic. That's avodah zarah. That's one of the four types of avodas that are problems of avodah zarah. But he says without incense, he says he was actually matir, and the Rashba got into a whole discussion about whether this Tzuras HaAryeh is mutter or not. A lengthy discussion, which we'll touch on some of the themes of the discussion soon. But we mentioned before the Rashba's correspondent said that the magic of the Torah Asers is real, and that's why the Torah Asers it, like the Reke Moach of the Ben Ezra, and the Rambam says no, the magic like Ben Ezra himself, the magic of the Torah Asers is not real. And this is directly relevant to this case of the Rashba. The Rashba's correspondent, some other chacham of that time, had argued that the Tzuras HaAryeh is asur, Because even if it's effective, even if it works, he says, that's exactly the point. The things the Torah prohibits, the Rashba's correspondent had written, someone who makes this surah at a certain time, who was believed, astrological benefits maybe, who was believed to be effective if it was done at a certain time, it's usur because of Lo Sa'oninu. That's one of the various prohibitions against the occult. Because, yes, it works, but the Torah, everything the Torah asurs works. And that's why it's usur, the Rashba's correspondent said. It works, and that's why it's usur. It's usur because it works. Now the Rambam believes everything that's usur does not work. So anything that does work, maybe is mutter. So these two approaches of whether the things the Torah prohibits are falsehood, sheker and chazav and hevel v'tohu, or real, that's why the Torah prohibits them, that's directly relevant when we try to consider what things are usur, what things are mutter. It's much more complicated than this. There are many other considerations as well. But this is one of the key questions. According to the traditional view that the magic of the Torah works, it follows from that just because something works, you can't prove from that it's mutter, because the Torah asks many things that work if they fall into the prohibited categories. Whereas according to the Rambam, everything the Torah prohibits is all bogus. And it follows anything that does work, there's a strong argument to be made that it should be mutter. This point is indeed made by both the Rambam and the Rashba, although the Rashba himself comes out that Surah Sa'ari is mutter anyway, but this point is made by both the Rambam and the Rashba. And the context is a Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos says, it's discussing the laws of Hotzah, the things you can carry and not carry, out or wear or carry outside on Shabbos. So in the course of that discussion, the Mishnah in Masechah Shabbos says, there are certain things that they used to go outside where there's no Erev on Shabbos. There were certain kinds of occult refuahs. We might call them superstitions, but there were certain kinds of bizarre-sounding therapeutic things that they permitted carrying or going outside, wearing or carrying these things on Shabbos. The Mishnah says you can go out with a locust egg, a beitz ha-sachargol, a shein shual, a fox's tooth, and masmer min atzalov, a nail from a person who was crucified, mishum refuah. These things were therapeutic or believed to be therapeutic. Rebbe Meir says you can therefore go out with them on Shabbos. The Chum say it's usur even during the week. Forget Shabbos. Even during the week where there's no usur of carrying, it's usur. Peshem Darchei Amori. Walking in the ways of the Amorites. The prohibition against pagan superstitions. How can you do these things, the Chum say? These are superstitions. The Halacha actually follows Rebbe Meir. These things are mutter. And the Gemara explains that the Beit Zachargol is for an earache. The fox's tooth is for sleep, helps you sleep, I guess. Or the other way around. It goes both ways. The tooth of a live fox is someone who's sleeping and needs to wake up. The tooth of a dead fox is for someone who's not sleeping, insomnia, and you need him to go to sleep. The nail from a crucified person is for a certain type of infection. These were all believed to be therapeutic. Rameir allows them. That's how we paskin. Abai and Rava say that they give a famous principle. They put forth the principle, kol davar sheyesh bo mishum refuah, anything that is done for therapeutic purposes that has therapeutic efficacy, ein bo mishum darchei hamari, is not prohibited, as darchei hamari is not prohibited on the grounds of pagan superstition. So this is a very important rule which the poskim accept. Anything which is therapeutically effective is not prohibited as Darchei Amari. Rambam in Mor Nevuchim discusses this principle at some length. Rambam writes as follows. Rambam writes, Kishuf, Rambam understands that many prohibitions in the Torah are related to Kishuf, in particular all the various prohibitions of magic. Rambam puts it all, as we mentioned, in Hilchos Avodah Zarah. He felt they were a gateway to Avodah Zarah. So Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim, in order to keep us away from Avodah Zarah, the Torah prohibits everything that is against logic, that's against reason, ein ha'iyun ativi mechaivo, that natural science, that reasoning about the laws of nature does not indicate that it should be effective. People do it anyway as a skula. That's what the Torah prohibits when it says v'loselchu b'chukos ha'goy, don't follow in the ways in the chukim, in the ordinances of the goyim. That's what Chazal meant by Darchei Amori. They're branches of sorcery and the Rasser. Why? Again, he repeats, because these are things that are not justified by reason and logical analysis, by science. She'ein higayon tivim mechayvam, logic and the analysis of natural science doesn't yield that these things should be effective. That's what Chazal meant when they said, Kol she'yesh bo mishum refuah mishum darchei amari. What do you mean, Kol she'yesh bo mishum refuah? Chazal meant anything that whose existence is just, whose effectiveness is justified by Iyun Hativi. The third time he uses that phrase, Iyun Hativi, that by science, by logical, rational analysis, anything that's not supported by that, anything supported by that is mutter, anything not supported by that is usser. That's how the Rambam understands. In order for something to be mutter, it has to be scientifically justified. Anything that's not logically, not scientifically justifiable is usser. What about the nail from the crucified person and the tooth of the fox and those things? Those don't sound very scientific. Says the Rambam, at those times, they believed that they had been demonstrated by experiment, by experience, by empirical evidence, and they were done for refuah. And the Rambam writes, anything that was nis'ames, nis'yono, kagon elu, anything whose effectiveness was demonstrated by experience, by empirical evidence, even if logic does not justify it, ein ha'igayon m'chayva mutter la'soso, that's mishum refuah, and that is okay. So the Rambam seems to have a glaring contradiction here. He begins by saying that it has to be justified by science and logic. And he's three times, he says, Iyun Hativi, Higayun Hativi. Three times he says we have to have a scientific, logical, rational justification for its effectiveness. He ends by saying, even though there are some examples in the Mishnah and the Gemara that clearly are not scientific, but they believe they were justified and they were supported by experiment, by empirical evidence, and therefore they're okay. So which is it? Does it depend on whether we have a scientific explanation for it? Or does it depend on whether we think we have empirical evidence for it? Which one does it depend on? The Rashba raises this question. In the course of the Rashba's long tshuva, he spends time on this Rambam. He writes that, Yeshli makom iyun b'divrei harav. I don't understand the Rambam, he says. Because he says that at one point he says anything that has nisayon, anything supported by experiment and evidence is mutter. But then he says that even something that works, if we don't have even something that has some evidence, but if we don't have a scientific justification for it, if we don't have iyun hativi, then we should ask for those things like the nail from the crucified person. It should be darchei amari. So he doesn't really understand what is it. Does it depend on experiment? Does it depend on scientific theoretical justification? And he says, he goes on, he struggles with the Rambam. He says that, furthermore, the Rashba asks, what does the Rambam mean when he says that when the Rambam mentions this criterion of having scientific justification? Who's science? What does it mean, science? He says, Aristotle and Galen, the great ancient Greek philosophers and physicians, he says, they wrote books on science and medicine and so on, he says. Anything that their science doesn't encompass is usher, he says. Were they really the be-all and end-all of science, he says? Is there nothing in the world that's beyond beyond their comprehension that they didn't fully grasp, he says? He says, they don't understand everything, he says. He gives examples, he says, even the chacham sheba chachamim, even the greatest chacham, he says, there are some aspects that are clearly natural aspects of the world, but they don't understand. Like magnetism, he says. Iron jumps to meet a magnet. Where does that come from, he says? The ships rely on it, the compasses and the ships. It's so reliable, he says. We don't understand everything. We don't have theories for everything. Even today, as science has progressed, much of the triumph of science in the last several hundred years has been descriptive. We can find equations. We find elegant and powerful equations that can describe accurately and can enable us to predict what will happen in the world. But is that called understanding? It's an interesting philosophical question. Gravity. Newton discovered the inverse square law, that the attraction between two bodies is inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. But does that mean we understand gravity? I think it was Newton himself who spoke of the unsatisfying quality of spooky action at a distance. How does that work? Today we have all kinds of quantum theories with mediating particles and gravitons maybe and whatnot. But again, so there's some things we still don't understand. There are some things that we anticipate being able to figure out eventually. But the Rashba is raising a very powerful question, which is that what does it mean that we require a scientific justification? Does it have to be theoretically possible even if we don't fully understand the mechanism? There are some things that we would say, unless we're totally missing the boat, are inconceivable for there to be a scientific explanation for. But even those things sometimes were found out to be true. before the revolution of quantum theory and the theory of relativity, who would have imagined that the things we believe today are possible? Things can be in multiple places at the same time. Things, space and time are curved. Who would have imagined these things as being possible? So it's very hard to know that this is really all the Rashba's point. In a way, it's a very modern point that when you say something is not scientific, what does that mean? Do you really have so much confidence? Or are we really so arrogant that we believe that, you know, Shakespeare said, yeah, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy? So does that really mean that anything we don't understand is anything we don't understand is us? Or that can't be. The Rashba says that lahalacha, going back to his halacha question, lahalacha, he says, putting aside these epistemological, philosophical questions about how we know what we know and how confident we are in our understanding, the Rashba says, from the sugya itself, the bottom line is, in his opinion, from the sugya itself, it's clear, even things that have no scientific explanation are mutter. The examples of the fox's tooth and the locust egg, there's no scientific explanation for that. It's mutter as long as they believe that it worked. It's not darchei amori. He says that kol sheyesh b'mishum refuah, you do all, as long as it's known. The question is, what standards of evidence do you have to meet? Do you have to have a double-blind, randomized controlled studies, double-blind, and so on, case studies, anecdotal evidence, what do you have to have? Rashba doesn't get into that. Some contemporary posts have tried to deal with that. The Rashba goes on, anything that's not mentioned in the Gemara is Darchei Amari. Some posts can take a very minimalist view of Darchei Amari. There's only an enumerated list of things that are us, or anything else is not us, or many posts can say it's more broad. Those are just examples. The Rashba says there are many things we don't understand. There are skulos and things that we don't know how they work, but they lachash in the Gemara, but they work apparently, and they're not Oster because of Darchei Amari. And here the Ramban used to do the Tzura Sa'ariye. So the Rashba takes a fairly lenient view. He says that we don't have to have a real scientific understanding. As long as it works and it's believed that evidence demonstrates that it works, that's sufficient. And this takes us also to the whole question of alternative medicine. For the last couple of centuries, modern science and modern medicine has become more confident and more rigid about what's science-based medicine and what's not. And we have all kinds of alternative medicines that have sprung up, people who claim that there are other things that Western medicine doesn't accept that still work. Going back to the 18th century, throughout the 19th century, the 20th century, into the 21st century. And the truth is, even within the scientific community, there's an interesting split I've been fascinated doing some reading about recently, a split between a group that calls itself the proponents of evidence-based medicine, EBM, and a group that calls itself proponents of science-based medicine, SBM. Evidence-based medicine is a paradigm that believes that we shouldn't rely too heavily on preconceptions, on theoretical beliefs about what should work or shouldn't work, what will work, what won't work. The only thing we want to know about is empirical evidence. Do a study, see what the study says. Until we do a study, we shouldn't express any great confidence based on our theories of what we expect and what we think should work, shouldn't work. The only thing that matters is evidence, evidence-based medicine. Alternative medicine as well, subjected to the same tests, the same studies, the same level of rigor. Don't come with any preconceptions. I can't imagine that would work. It's not scientific. The only thing that matters is evidence. Submit everything to the same standards of evidence and trials and so on, and then decide what works and what doesn't work. The science-based medicine people, they push back against that, and they say, Science gives us a certain sense of prior plausibility. Trials are not perfect. There are artifacts. There are outlier cases. There are poor quality studies, and we very much should approach these questions with a sense of prior plausibility based on science. Some things are just so ridiculous from a scientific perspective. Even if we have some weak studies that show that they have some effectiveness, it's doubtless an artifact of the study. It's doubtless a fluke. It doesn't mean anything. And we shouldn't be given credence. We shouldn't limit ourselves, refuse to make any comment beyond what emerges from the evidence. And they fight vigorously about different types of alternative medicine and so on. Some of the controversy has been about things like homeopathy or acupuncture. Homeopathy goes back to the 18th century. A German fellow, Hahnemann, who believed that like can cure like, whatever substance causes the problem can cure the problem. The problem is, if you take more arsenic, it'll just kill you. So the answer is, you dilute it. You dilute it to massive, massive levels of dilution, to the extent that there's scientifically not even going to be a single molecule of the original substance left. You've diluted it so badly. And they believe that'll cure the disease. How can that work? It doesn't make any sense if there's nothing left of the original substance. They have all kinds of theories. Water memory, the diluted, the dilution stuff remembers the old thing. Not very scientific, according to modern Western science, but they believe it works. Mainstream science thinks that's ridiculous, that that's the ultimate in quackery. The evidence-based medicine people say, do testing, do more tests, get good studies and do it. The science-based medicine people say, it's ridiculous, it can't work, we shouldn't even waste time on studies. If the studies show otherwise, they're just ridiculous, there's something wrong with the study. But these things are vehemently argued about, and with even more and more prominent, prestigious universities and medical centers have begun opening departments of what they call integrative medicine, where they're going to integrate the best of alternative medicine with Western medicine, complementary medicine, and all kinds of holistic medicine, all kinds of new terms for it, fine-sounding terms. And this is a hotly debated point in the modern scientific and medical community as well. In halacha, there are a series of tshuvas of poskim, not really a series, but a number of tshuvas of poskim discussing alternative medicine, going back to the 19th century. One of them is a tshuva of the Binyan Tzion, Rav Yaakov Etchlinger, who my father always points out was one of the first Western rabbanim to actually have a university education. He was asked about something called magnetizirin. Magnetism, which was basically mesmerism, a form of animal magnetism, they called it. Basically, we would call hypnosis. Today, we use hypnosis in the field of psychology to help treat psychological conditions. But back then, it was believed it had all kinds of incredible powers to cure all kinds of diseases. And they asked the Binyan Tzion, a certain tzaddik who was suffering gravely from some illness. People recommended he try mesmerism. It was a fad, a popular thing in the 19th century. And the person was worried. Maybe it uses occult forces, kochos atumah. Am I allowed to do this? Says Binyan Tzion, I consulted with the Gentile scholars. I said, what is this magnetizirin? Does it work? Is it natural or supernatural? I got different opinions, he says. Some say it's all hevel v'chazav. It just manipulates the minds of the patients to think that things are happening, but it's all manipulation. None of it is real. Others said, no, it's a real thing. Modern science hasn't figured it out yet, but we don't know everything yet. Have a little humility. It's a great power that we don't fully understand, but it's a real thing. Says Binyan Tzion that he thinks it is therefore mutter. I'm not taking sides whether it works or not, he says. It's not occult, he says. The people who believe it say it's a form of science, and the people who don't believe it say it's wrong. But it's not a question of magic and science. Even things that are occult, the Gemara says that if they work, if there's no avodah zarah involved, he says, we had kol sheyesh bo mishum refuah and mishum darchei amari. As long as the Novodas are involved, he says, it's okay. He says, even things that, like the Rashba says, science doesn't fully understand everything in nature anyway, he says. And the science has only figured out a tipa minayam of everything that exists in the universe, he says. Therefore, he says, magnetizirin is mutter. Even if it's not a question of sakana, there's no reason to prohibit it. It's not a vodazara. It's not even occult, he says. Even occult, some posts can allow, he says, if there's... If it's pikuach nefesh, so some people allow even kishuf, he says, and so on. So it's basically he feels that it's not an issue. There's no isser here, even if it's not pikuach nefesh. There's no isser. There's no avodah zarah going on here, he says. Even things that are not scientific are mutter, he says. Lots of things we don't understand. Why should this mesmerism be any different from other things we don't understand? He says it's derech hateva. We just may not. If it works, it's derech hateva. We just don't really understand it, and therefore it's mutter. That was the opinion of some poskim regarding homeopathy as well. In the mid to late 20th century, there was a rabbi in Antwerp, I think, who was a Rav Chaim Rosenberg of Antwerp. He had questions about homeopathy. Homeopathy involves dilution, where they take a substance and they dilute it over and over and over again, dilute it to 1 in 100, and then take a drop of that mixture and dilute it to another 1 in 100. They do that over and over and over again until you have a 1 with a lot of zeros and how badly it was diluted. The question was, if the initial ingredient is a davar aser, chametz on Pesach, or an iser, is the resulting mixture mutter to eat? On the one hand, we say things are batel. When by the time you have one with lots of zeros, it's normally batel. On the other hand, in mevatel iser l'chatchila, you're not allowed to engage in bitul l'chatchila. So this Rabbi Rosenberg had questions about the halachic technical halachic questions about homeopathy, which he posed to various gedolei Torah. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Menashe Klein, also in New York, and Rav Shmuel Vosner in Bnei Brak. Rav, the Shevet Halevi had a discussion back and forth, is it mutra or not? And he said, the question revolves to a certain extent on whether homeopathy, science doesn't understand it, but to the extent that it works, is it based on magic or is it based on science? Is it, Kinnear, it's based on science, it makes sense to him, he says, that the same substance that caused the problem could cure the disease. He thinks it is scientifically rational per his understanding of science, and he's inclined to say that it's mutter. Rav Menashe Klein as well was inclined to say that it was mutter. Rav Moshe Feinstein did not write a tshuva in his own hand on this topic, but his son-in-law, Rav Moshe David Tendler, published a tshuva in a rabbinic journal, the journal Hamar, in 1983, where he said, Rabbi Tendler wrote, my father dictated this letter to me and asked me to publicize this in his name. He says, he asked me to inform you in his name. He doesn't want to enter into your shilas. Even though there are halakhically interesting questions you're raising, he says, he doesn't want to get involved in the shilas because he's opposed to homeopathy in general. He says, homeopathy cannot be called a tried and true, a tested therapy, which would be mutter to use without being against Ratzon Hashem. Homeopathy basically is bogus, and therefore it's connected to Ratzon Hashem. Why? A medical doctrine, Shita Refuis, that denigrates rational thought, and it leads to Emunah and Hevel and nonsense, and it leads people toward Avodah Zarah, an approach to the world which is anti-rational, which rejects rationalism and rational thought, leads one to Avodah Zarah, and to belief in hidden things, and to deny the laws of nature established by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I don't want to be involved in such doctrines. Rav Moshe says, therefore, I will not even engage in the halachic aspects of your question. So Rav Moshe, according to his son-in-law, Rav Moshe David Tendler, took the position that since homeopathy is fundamentally anti-scientific, it's anti-rational, that itself makes it against the Torah, and you're not permitted, again, in the 19th century, when the Binyan Tzion wrote about mesmerism, scientists themselves were split. The science was more of the Wild West. There's a lot that wasn't understood. At some point, some of these alternative ideas could be taken seriously by scientists. But by the late 20th century, where homeopathy was nearly universally rejected by the scientific community, Rabbi Tendler says, his father-in-law Moshe held, that because it is fundamentally an anti-scientific, anti-rational approach to the world, that itself is against Torah, it's dangerous, it's spiritually dangerous, it can lead to the rejection of God's laws of nature and to belief in magic and idols, and therefore Moshe felt it was wrong, it's fundamentally against Torah to believe such things. Some people challenged, some of the other Rabbanim involved in this discussion challenged Rabbi Tendler for putting words into Moshe's mouth. They said that that's not the way Moshe spoke, he didn't use language like this, it's not the way his mind works. So there are those who challenge the idea that this is really Rav Moshe speaking rather than Rabbi Tendler speaking, but this is what Rav Tendler says, his father-in-law said.
Is it Asr because they use some non-kosher things and they dilute it, or is it Asr?
Rav Moshe was asking not because of that. He was asking because the Shita itself is inherently, at least the way I read it, the Shita itself, because it's anti-rational and anti-science, it's that itself makes it Asr, I think he's saying, because it's hashgafically Asr, because it's against the God. Hashem made the world with Derech HaTeva, and he wants us to understand the Chachma of his Teva, and belief in irrational and anti-scientific thinking can lead to belief in Kishuv and Avodah Zarah and bad beliefs. So the sheet itself is fundamentally against the Torah.
I'm in this Asr to the Rational?
So we'll get to that now. So we'll get to that exact Lashon. Compare this to it, contrast this to a tshuva of Rav Asher Weiss. A great tshuva, I love this tshuva from Rav Asher Weiss, contemporary authority. They said, Rav Asher Weiss says, a relatively short tshuva in his published tshuvas, he says, you asked me about complementary medicine, Rufuah Mashlima, that's one of the names for alternative medicine, complementary medicine. They don't want to deny Western medicine, but they want to add things to complement it. So you asked me about Rufuah Mashlima, complementary medicine, Kagon. He gives several examples. The shita of one brain, moach echad, the shita of kinesiology, and primarily the shita of EFT. EFT, emotional freedom techniques, that they push certain pressure points on the body, and that's supposed to release toxic memories that are causing problems. It's connected to psychology, but it's considered a pseudo-scientific, not scientific extension or branch of psychology. EFT, they call it. pretty popular in the firm world. I've seen several articles, testimonials about it in Mishpacha over the last year, Mishpacha magazine. So, says Rav Asher, you asked particularly about this, that those who practice it believe that you can even do it remotely, you can transmit energy to the body. You asked me, is it permitted to engage in these practices, or are they problems of Darkei Amari? Says Rav Asher Weiss, you do not ask my opinion as to whether I think these are effective or worthy techniques, he says. In my opinion, most of these things, these fads that people chase after, he says, are divrei shtus vehevel, are nonsense and stupid, he says. However, achatara lo asur lishtatus, the Torah does not prohibit being stupid, he says. So I think these things are stupid, but the Torah doesn't prohibit stupidity. So you're asking me as a posik, he says, you're asking me for the halacha, he says, lanias daiti, there is no issur at all, no issur to be stupid, he says, because those who say, similar to the Binyan Tzion, those who say it works, they say it's based on teva, physical laws of nature, nafshi, psychological, spiritual laws, he says. It's not a skula. We're not dealing with magic and occult, he says. These things, it's true that the scientific community doesn't accept it, and I, Rav Asher, think they're stupid. They're stupid fads. But at the end of the day, very similar to the Binyan Tzion, those who are proponents of these things are not claiming to be practicing magic and occult. They're just doing things that they believe are part of the laws of nature of the world. And again, he invokes the cardinal rule, Rav Asher here, we saw the Rambam says it either means there's a scientific justification for it or that there's empirical evidence. Here, I'm not sure there's either of these. Rav Asher thinks it's stupid and there isn't much scientific justification for it. The scientific community doesn't think so. It's hard to argue that there's any solid evidence for this. Rav Asher is not claiming there is. He seems to be understanding maybe a third approach. Anything which, at least in the mind of the practitioners, is being done from the perspective of Derech HaTeva, not from the perspective of an occult magical procedure, is mutter. I mean, is he really disagreeing with the Rambam's formulations? I'm not sure. But in any event, Rav Asher says exactly what I think you were saying before, that yes, it's stupid, he says, but there's no issue to be stupid. We always quote, there's a famous story about Rav Soloveitchik that comes in two versions. They asked him about, in martial arts, Japanese martial arts, Eastern martial arts, there's often a custom that opponents bow to each other in the course of a match, or they bow to the sensei, maybe. So they asked Rav Soloveitchik, is it permitted to do this bowing? Does Judaism allow bowing down to a person? So Rav Soloveitchik thought it was stupid. So in one version of the story, he said, it's not usher, but it's stupid. Now, I don't know why Rav Soloveitchik thought it was stupid. Plenty of cultures bow as a sign of respect. We just had in the Torah, it says they bow to the kings. The halacha, when anyone visits the king, even the Navi, he's supposed to bow to the king, like we find in the Haftarah, that Nasan, when he came into David, he bowed before David. Vayishtak Yisrael Rosh Hamita, some say in Parshas Vayechi, it means he bowed to Yosef, who was the viceroy of the king. The bowing to a king, or even is considered normal. So I don't know why bowing is a sign of respect in Oriental culture. The Rav thought was stupid, but Rav Soloveitchik apparently thought the bowing was stupid. Maybe he thought in the context of martial arts, you're not Japanese, adopting these errors of another country was stupid. But Rav Soloveitchik felt the bowing was stupid. So in one version of the story, he said, it's not usher, but it's stupid. In another version of the story, he said, it's not inherently usher, but it's stupid. And because it's stupid, it's usher, because it's usher to be stupid. So the two versions of the story disagree about this question, about whether it's usher to be stupid or not. Rav Asher tells us explicitly that in his formal published tshuva, there is no issur to be stupid, hatara lo asra lishtatus, while Rav Moshe, as reported by Rav Moshe David Tandler, his son-in-law, sounds like he's saying some version of the position. It is asur to be stupid. It's asur to adopt a fundamentally anti-rational, anti-scientific approach, because it can lead to denial of the orderly laws of nature, belief in kishuv and avodah zarah, and reject the God's vision for the world. Again, people challenge whether Moshe actually wrote that. But I'll call upon him. The overall attitude of the poskim is like the Binyan Tzion say, like the Shevet Alevi says, I think, like Rav Asher Weiss says. As long as there's no real occult aspect to these things, we're not dealing with avodah zarah or real pagan superstitious things, it's going to be mutter. Now, some poskim worry that certain forms of alternative medicine do have these occult roots. Some of the Oriental medicines, the Chinese medicines, they talk about qi and life force, which energies which can lead to avodah zarah. Rav Belsky was famous for having done his own research into these practices, and he was actually quite strict about some of them. He felt some of them do have roots in occult and pagan occult and fundamentally religiously troubling approaches. So some of them actually involve the occult and the idolatrous and the pagan. But assuming they don't, assuming that they're just like homeopathy, the things that are just at worst unscientific and pre-scientific and unscientific understanding of the world, so that the general attitude of postkim seems to be that those are okay, as per the Binyan Tzion, as per Rav Asher, as per the Shevet HaLevi. We do have Rav Moshe, as claimed by his son-in-law, who said that adopting a shita that is fundamentally anti-scientific is problematic, although again, it's not clear where this comes from, this idea that acting in an unscientific way, especially if in your head you believe this is scientific, you believe that the scientific establishment is narrow-minded and wrong, and you believe you are acting in a scientific way, which the practitioners of homeopathy do, I think, by and large, as misguided as they may be. So the question is there really any basis for prohibiting it? That seems to be a chiddush of Rav Moshe, as quoted by his son-in-law, Rav Tendler.